It's said that once a coaster, always a coaster. In fact, there's no such thing as an ex-coaster. For Developing West Coast for Ebra Coaster Series, I'm interviewing business people whose careers may have taken them away, but they still have a strong connection. And today, I'm talking to Jana Sullivan. Jana is calling in all the way from London, where she's Global Legal Counsel for The Story Lab, a development producer and distributor of entertainment content. And Jana's going to provide us with some great ideas of what the West Coast could do to attract more screen production. So today I'd like to welcome Jana Sullivan. Tēnā koe, Jana, all the way from London. How is it there?
Well, in London at the moment, it's very mask central. We, you know, haven't been able to go to pubs yet, but they're now open. We've been social distancing left, right and centre. Everywhere you go, there's sanitising stations and routes with arrows about where you can walk, so you're not crossing paths. It's, I'd say, a pretty unfriendly environment, actually. You know, we've had a crazy time with UK government advice. It's been completely confusing. I laugh about it now, but the PR campaign of stay alert for COVID is pretty random. They've brought all these different rules in, which are quite confusing to follow. There's the rule that when it opened up slightly in June, you could have six people in a backyard garden, but you weren't allowed to be in a house so that you could be social distancing and fresh air. But Julie, as I'm sure you know, most gardens in London at least, and most of the country really, are terraced. So, you know, you can't even get to the garden without walking through the house. So we're not quite sure how that was supposed to work. And then what happens if you need the bathroom? Personally, I'd say I've sort of just really missed travel and also just being able to socialise without wildly overthinking. So, yeah, interesting.
You weren't tempted to come rushing home to New Zealand when COVID hit?
I mean, I was obviously tempted to come rushing home, but it was also like with a toddler and everything, it was obviously quite a stressful thought to kind of package him up and get him home. And the quarantine, because New Zealand did react so quickly, came in so quickly with the 14 days, it kind of became a bit of a reality check that we'd have a 20-month-year-old bouncing off the walls for 14 days inside a hotel. So we kind of, you know, thought twice about it. But I think obviously as time has gone on, it has seemed more and more appealing, that's for sure.
How do the English media or English people, how do they feel about how New Zealanders handled the COVID crisis?
Well, Julie, Jacinda's always in the Times or Guardian for something. I mean, she's looked upon really favourably given her sincere dealing with the mosque shootings and obviously also the volcanic eruptions, gun law changes, and of course the original sort of fact of being a mother and a leader of the country at once. So I would say, you know, in particular, New Zealand's looked on favourably because of that. You know, she sort of acted so swiftly and clearly, and therefore New Zealand acted so swiftly and clearly in relation to the COVID crisis. And it was sort of in direct contrast to the UK kind of dilly-dallying. So like many countries, the media were wanting to trade in Boris for her straight away. It's actually funny sort of thinking about other perspectives, because on many work calls, because I work quite globally, people are always saying to me, oh my God, it's amazing, New Zealand's COVID-free, and why aren't you back? Exactly your question. And I'm like really proud of it for sure. But I have explained that it is kind of a bit more of an achievable goal, being such a small island nation that is so isolated. COVID-free would really be so incredibly difficult for an EU country to achieve, even one going through Brexit. Because you just can't close your borders up due to the Schengen principles, and most countries in the EU obviously border other countries and not onto the sea. So I think it's quite hard for either of our countries to sort of appreciate what it's like. But yeah, the perception of New Zealand and Jacinda in the media has been amazing. So we should be very proud.
You still have family on the coast. Of course, plenty of people will know your dad, Tony, who of course practices law at Haddam and Seddon and Greymouth. Was that inevitable career choice for you going into law following Dad?
Well, actually, Julie, Mum's way more a coaster than Dad. Ranunga, Waimangaroa, Greymouth, Bullahi, Greyhi. So, no, Dad had definitely blazed a bit of a path, which had provided me with some insight into that world for sure. So there was some commonality there. But Dad's law is very different, and I'd say probably more noble than what I do. I guess, you know, statistics show there's an inherent knowledge share by people in a position of influence, which Dad would have been for me. So I probably did subconsciously go down that path a bit, but Dad himself has never remotely pressured me into the law. And he's pretty amazing with just wanting for us whatever makes us happy. From my own perspective, I was always good at English and history. So when I went to uni, I thought, well, I'll do political science and law and sort of see what happens. And then I did pretty well at law in my first year. So I thought, well, great. I'll continue along that track with the ultimate intention actually of doing a postgrad journalism course at Canterbury. But then I was doing honours law and got the big law firms sort of sweep you off your feet. And I was quite young, kind of 21. So I just sort of swept up and wanting to start earning money and wanting to live in the city, et cetera, et cetera. So I did follow him.
You went to Minter Ellison?
Correct. Yeah, that was where I went and sort of finished my training and, yeah, became a solicitor.
So how did you get from head girl at Grey High to negotiating global licensing agreements in the screen production industry? Can you talk us through the major moves in your career journey?
I remember being a third former sitting in the Grey High Assembly and head girl at the time was speaking, and I was just like, I will be here in 5 years. I'll make that happen. So I guess you could say that I had like an innate confidence and drive about things I felt it was really important for me to achieve. But I hadn't probably ever seen myself as a partner of a law firm personally. So really working my way up. And I was good in trusting my instinct to try and get out of the private practice style of law when I had the opportunity to do so. And of course, Julie, that was when yourself and your brother Mike really opened up a door to me, to a world that I felt really driven and excited by. I was lucky to see how all the cogs worked at iWorks. You not only let me work on the legal side, but I was also involved in the development and sponsorship integration work. And I, you know, wish I was really creative to be a director or a developer of ideas, but I kind of worked out pretty swiftly that I was more of a finisher, sort of better on the business side. And probably also that this was often a skill that only a few people in the industry really had. iWorks was such an amazing eye-opener into the world I wanted to remain in. And so obviously I'm incredibly grateful for that opportunity. And I then moved on to London and got onto some media recruiters' books. And I remember I had this big weekend away and then they wanted me to interview at BBC Worldwide at like 8:30 a.m. on Monday morning. And I got the message as I was on the train on Friday night down to Brighton. And I remember thinking, oh my God, I only have a leather jacket to wear to my interview, because I had to go straight from Brighton to the television centre at BBC. But, you know, I spent 5 years at BBC and I gained some incredible experience and worked with such a wide variety of people. So many different countries, from like Kazakhstan to Iceland to Turkey to South Africa, and just amazing programming. You know, New Zealand's familiar, but you've got from Fawlty Towers, Top Gear, Bake Off, whatever, it's all there. And actually, I was looking to move home at that point, so after 5 years in the UK, and it was amidst that I was contacted by a recruiter about a job that really had me stepping up as its sole global legal counsel. And I kind of thought there's no chance I'll get it, but, you know, good to do the interview practice after 5 years of doing no interviews before I move home anyway. So I got through the first round, and then I got through the second round, and then I felt a bit guilty for leading them on with no intention of actually staying in the UK. But then, as these things sometimes happen, you know, Willie's mum passed away really unexpectedly in New Zealand, and it kind of made us question a lot of things. And she'd always said quite poignantly, you know, life isn't a dress rehearsal. And I just thought, you know what, life is so short. I wasn't quite done with travel in Europe. It was perfect timing for me to really step up and challenge myself in my career. I didn't have any kids or anything then. And, you know, it was intense when I just joined the Story Lab. It was loads to get my head around, a lot of pressure establishing everything, precedents, processes, contracts for what was effectively a startup, as well as just having to meet and greet heaps of internal stakeholders. But it's one of the things I'm sort of most proud of, and it's really helped me back myself and my capabilities. So what does
global legal counsel for the Story Lab, a developer, producer and distributor of entertainment content, do every day? What's your day-to-day life look like?
So Julie, I mean, I do all sorts of things at the Story Lab. It's sort of a quasi-legal and commercial sort of strategy role. We do lots of licensing of programs and formats into different countries, and then take these through licenses into facilitating local sponsorship or content partnerships or advertiser-funded programming. So things like using a car manufacturer in All-Star Celebrity Driving School formats, and then using other marketing and activations around that car brand for the show. You know, the content we deal with can be anything from like a podcast to a free-to-air television show to Unilad Facebook clips or even Netflix films and Instagram TV. It's very broad.
It is, that's right. And so when you look back at what you've achieved now, what impact do you think growing up on the coast had on you?
I mean, you know, it had a huge impact. Well, I grew up with, I would say personally, quite a lot of personal privilege. I am friends with and went to school with heaps of kids of all socioeconomic levels, which I really think makes you both respectful and have quite a heightened EQ too. I believe that, you know, the coast may be pretty woke, as they say these days, but I think the coast really defines you in the sense that you never feel quite pigeonholed to a specific type. People don't really quite know where to place you when you move out of the coast. And I think it's a bit like that being an Antipodean in London too. I think there's like a West Coast X factor almost that can kind of work to your advantage. When you think that, you know, less than 1% of New Zealand population lives on the coast, you're kind of a bit of a novelty when you're from there. And it probably does give you a bit of a reputation that precedes yourself. But, you know, if perceptions are automatically negative, then it is also quite motivating to prove people wrong. I think, you know, for every single law interview I went for and everything, at least in my last year of uni, the main fascination that they wanted to talk about, the subject matter, was always, you know, oh my gosh, you're from Greymouth. Did you go to Grey High? Wow, what happened? Like, how is Grey High? How are you here? Which isn't great to say, but, you know, I guess what I'm saying is you're original, and I'm sure they found me a real refreshing change from their usual type of interviewee. I'd say on a slightly more negative front, I think the coast can give you a bit of a heightened sense of imposter syndrome and possibly humbleness, which at times is a great thing for sure to have. But in my development reviews, they probably have pulled out as it is a bit of a feature to work on. Like, you don't have to be unkind or really obnoxious to be assertive about yourself, but you do have to be confident and willing to back yourself talking about your achievements and the value you can add.
I think it's interesting you bring up the imposter syndrome, because I have that too. So do you want to tell
really
tell me? I know it's much more common in women. So tell us a little bit about the imposter syndrome.
Well, I think for me, Julie, it does get better as I get older and I realize that not found out yet. So hopefully that means that things are okay and I'm not kind of mucking things up or kind of going into a room and people are behind the scenes thinking she doesn't know what she's talking about. But essentially I would say imposter syndrome is when you feel like an imposter in the work environment or any environment really that you are in, and you feel unconfident in your ability and that someone's about to tap you on the shoulder and say, you've lasted here long enough, but no one's pulling the wool over their eyes any longer. So, you know, as I said, I think years of experience and things like that really help. And I think for me, it's been quite interesting talking about that recently, because I was, you know, on mat leave sort of a year ago, well, just under a year ago, and coming back in probably gave me a bit of imposter syndrome again. It was sort of intimidating. I hadn't felt like I'd been really in that work world, and gosh, give it 2 weeks and you're back in and everyone's slamming you with work again, it's fine. But it's just interesting to find that it will come back at different stages stronger too.
You're on what you call mat leave, maternity leave.
Maternity leave.
You know, no, it's a great term for maternity.
I've been back since August last year or whatever.
Did you find it challenging coming back in after maternity leave?
Yeah, I definitely did, without a doubt. I mean, again, like, I have a natural inclination, I'd say, to imposter syndrome, so that probably didn't help. And I also had a really amazing mat cover who I was able to organise with our general counsel to bring in and everything, so that was brilliant. But, you know, he was really, really good. And that's what I wanted. I didn't want to come in and have someone who had been fluttering around and that I would have so many things to muck up, or they hadn't been doing things the way I like them or using my precedence. So I really wanted someone, because it had only been me and I'd set up everything, who would say, look, I've been looking at your contracts. I agree with this, but I challenge this, because that's another person improving you and what you can produce. But obviously, he was amazing. He was actually more senior than me, and he's really, really confident in his abilities. So it was quite intimidating. But actually, when I came back, we'd sort of grown so much, and we were both looking to have a bit more of a commercial role. So now we do a complete share of legal and commercial across the board. And I think that really was quite flattering to me, showing how much work I did actually churn out when it was just one of me. So yeah, it's been tough, but you know, I think you get confidence once you're back in the grind.
What are your best memories of growing up in Greymouth in particular on the coast?
Well, from a London perspective, I think the first thing would be say, we don't lock our house and car, don't burgle us. But the safety of it, you know, not having to be constantly aware of where your handbag or even your pram at the playground is. Having Fred now means I also look at kind of the urban culture for kids growing up around me in London and feel that I was definitely able to embrace the innocence of youth more than I would have in a big city. The seafood, love fish. I'd also say the access to the outdoors. You know, I could play netball on a Saturday in winter, ski on a Sunday, then get home and walk the dog on the beach if I wanted to. You know, that's crazy for most countries in the world to comprehend. And I guess that led on to sort of the sports and ability to be well-rounded, which is so unique too. And that's one of my main memories of certainly high school and everything, you know, basketball, netball, athletics, cross-country, cricket, rugby. I also dance, so literally had the opportunity to play all sports and represent the coast where I could too and where I got in, you know. The timing of games, the small time it takes to get anywhere in Greymouth, and, you know, not so expensive subscriptions and things means that I feel like that's not such a big reality in a big city, and everything is much easier to kind of fit in Greymouth.
Yeah, that's right.
Julie, I was just going to say, you know, seeing people you know all the time is also a really neat memory. You know, people just seem so happy to see you and they remember you. So that's quite unique. But, you know, every time you go to New World, knowing that you'll probably see someone you know is actually quite stressful and full on to think about as well, I've got to say.
In my case, they speak to me thinking I'm my sister.
Oh, really? Therese. Yeah.
What about the memories of the family batch at Punakaiki, of course?
There's nothing kind of like the heading up the coast road on a good day, you know. You're going up for a bit of a swim. You're going to have some ice cream. You've got to do that windy hairpin road and try and not spew it up. But yeah, I mean, just such good memories of relaxing. You only have to kind of, you know, run around the London Commons 1,000 times since lockdown to really have an appreciation for how incredible that West Coast rainforest is. And when I was having Freddie actually in a home birth that did not eventuate, funnily enough, I did hypnotherapy and had to envision my safe, happy place. And it was always Punakaiki. It is those cliffs where they're like almost falling onto the, you know, the batch. It's the sound of the sea, the open fire, Kiwiana features, the beautiful rivers, the Nikaus. And I also think it's amazing that you can go for walks there from like the Purari to the Punakaiki, and you kind of traverse like three different types of forest. And also just the fact that often in a low season, at least, there's like no one around, which is amazing. Great memories. Take me back.
The home birth, which didn't turn out to be a home birth. I imagine that's another story though.
I won't go into those details today.
Do you look at any of your personal attributes now and say that's so West Coast, I am what I am because of the West Coast?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think just from a personal context, I tend to really trust people on their word. Obviously, in a kind of work career context and being a skeptical lawyer, and I'd say working internationally with some, say, less trusting countries, I've learned that I shouldn't be so trusting, but on a personal basis, I probably am. Willie always gets really, he's just from Upper Hutt, by the way, so it's not like he's from anywhere else, but he always gets really embarrassed as I engage with random people in London. He's like, I mean, I'm nowhere on a level with my mum, who made friends with Janine from Tesco's every time she went there, but I do usually make a bit of an effort, you know. Certainly if people look confused around public transport, or if it's a barista or a shop I go to heaps. When I was pregnant, the fish and chip man always wanted to drive me home And I've had a few free flat whites in my time, Julie, so I'm not complaining. We've also got quite a funny story on the tube that I always think is so greymouth. We were actually heading back to New Zealand for the first time, and it was a really busy tube out to Heathrow, and I sort of managed to get a seat, but Willie had both of our bags down the end. And he, when I got to over to him after, he's like, oh my God, these guys just keep looking at me. And they were looking down at my bags and they're looking at me and looking at my bags. And as we all got off at the airport, I saw them and I was like, hi. And they were a few years older than me at high school. And they were like, we could see Greymouth 7805 on your bag tag, but we were looking at this guy and thinking he's not from Greymouth. So that was such a coast story for
me. They were from Greymouth as well.
Yeah, and they could just see the Greymouth address and they were like, he's not from Greymouth. I know people from Greymouth.
So, because you do come from a Runanga mining family.
A bit nervous to show my labour roots in front of you, Julie. No, I think a Runanga mining family gives you, good sense of humour, but it makes you gutsy. You know, you're pretty... got a pretty good hard work ethic. I've been down the Terrace Mine in Reefton actually a few years back when Granddad was involved with it. And I can assure you from that morning, it's a tough life doing that day in, day out. I think family values come a lot from that sort of upbringing too. You know, being a mother alone in London has given me such a respect for what places must have been like in sort of Runanga and Blaketown and everything in the 60s and 70s. What an incredible way to grow up. I know it's not that way now in any small towns really in New Zealand, but I do feel like I've sort of inherited those community values and, you know, they give you good self-awareness, but they really let you know what's kind of important to you for sure.
Yeah. You spent 5 years working at BBC Worldwide and recently we all saw the Luminaries series, the BBC Luminaries series was launched based on the book, which was set partly in Hokitika. And some of the filming was done on the coast. Is screen production an opportunity for small regions like ours, or do you think it's a big city thing?
I mean, I think there is a fantastic opportunity to market the coast as a place for screen productions. I think there could be some real value in sort of the coast playing up to itself as a bit of a home of, so, you know, mountains, beach, rivers, lakes, all at once. I mean, we're English speaking, so it's attractive to US, UK productions automatically. And it's certainly a place where random people won't be walking across your sets all day. It's also quite good seasonally. So you can sort of film in the Southern Hemisphere summer for a Northern Hemisphere summer release. It's obviously diverse and scenic regions are really attractive. And then certainly from a tourism perspective, I guess there's that follow-on effect of productions being free advertising as well for a globally distributed show. So that Lord of the Rings effect. So I think there is quite a tourism and production link that could be, taken advantage of. I was reading a Condé Nast Traveller article the other day and their contributor was still talking about how the piano was his inspiration for New Zealand visits every year. And I thought people do really like to make a pilgrimage for films and productions of stunning scenery. I think, unfortunately, though, in reality, the situation is often that production has very tight budgets and time constraints. And that's even for BBC shows like the Luminaries. So it is always a business. And if you have a guarantee of long series or lots of films, then it is easier to justify a really specific location like the coast or a Hobbiton. But if you've got the option to film something at a fraction of the cost, but with close to the same effect, then unfortunately, that's probably what they'll do. So shows, including the Luminaries, were sort of largely shot on location central to Auckland, with just a select few kind of vital shots being on Lake Canary and its nearby Crooked River. But then there is that argument for artist integrity, which is important to make sure the story is really accurate. So I think that definitely encouraged some of the shots being on the coast, which is great.
The harsh reality is needing to be close to top hotels for stars and that sort
exactly.
of thing. It is a hard reality, isn't it? But like you said, as integrity becomes more and more important in the industry, there could be a push towards having to actually be in their location. Is there anything the coast could do you think, to make itself more attractive?
I mean, Julie, you know, as we sort of touched on, it's driven by budgets, but I mean, tax breaks is always something. We really need to lobby the government to provide tax rebates for production shot on local locations. And I think if you've got that buy-in from New Zealand Tourism to effectively sort of sponsor this as a means of marketing the coast as a production hotspot, then that adds another pressure. In other words, like if you film in a city in New Zealand, this is your tax break. However, if you went more locally to a region, then actually we'll give you this, which is obviously a greater tax deduction instead.
And I agree entirely. You know, the government could consider giving definitely further tax breaks for regional production.
I really think it should. You know, the Taranakis, the coasts. I mean, your questions really made me think, God, I have to think about it. But I've for a week been really thinking about it. And I think there's real legs there. Why couldn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
And I also think what you were saying before, you know, there is a real attraction of the coast if we can play up to sort of the desire for sustainable production practices. So proving a limited environmental impact and from the outset, you know, proving that we've already developed a good working partnership with local iwi so that rights associated with local Maori land are considered appropriately. The industry is really wanting to be much more socially aware, and investors and funders want to see proof of this as well before they pay out. So it's quite a unique selling point if the coast could really kind of clearly play up to that sustainable production narrative as well as part of its marketing. I think we also need to be sure of having pragmatic decision-making processes and quick turnarounds on things like permits and allowances for filming. You know, I have been privy to some discussions about sports events on the Paparoa Great Walk. And admittedly, DOC has been really slow and kind of convoluted in its responses about that. And I totally appreciate that they have so many bodies to involve, like Forest and Bird. But, you know, any long permission processes are not going to help the film and TV investors, particularly global ones, be motivated to work with local areas if there's no sort of approval guarantees and they know the responses will be really slow. I think, you know, filming is so low impact, there is some capacity for a governmental commitment to standardize approvals process and have a quick turnaround. But I mean, Julie, you did mention that there is a bit of a question about the coast inaccessibility and infrastructure, limited flights, you know, state highway in and out, and there's gear and personnel and talent who are having to travel in. So I'd sort of love to know a lot more about, like, you know, what were the decisions around like Perfect Strangers, which filmed in Punakaiki itself. And maybe it is easier to achieve the coast as a production hub for a more art house independent like that, or say a survivalist reality like a Bear Grylls or Ed Stafford, than it would be for saying like, let's do a Hollywood blockbuster here. And then is that the niche that we look to market towards for production on the coast?
Yeah. It's definitely a niche. There's a niche market out there in TV production, that's for sure. Do you think that the relatively good performance of this country in a COVID will make it more attractive to international film and TV productions?
I mean, I definitely think that the global perception of New Zealand's leadership and brand as a safe haven is hugely beneficial, and that this will live past COVID times. On a day-to-day basis, I mean, I'm constantly contracting out of COVID-related delays. But in New Zealand, that isn't part of the risk, of course. I think in New Zealand right now, if it can negotiate, you know, its immunity passports really clearly, and, you know, the 14-day quarantine situation is all comfortable, then it could really commoditize the COVID environment. And that will be so enticing. But I think as soon as we have a vaccine and COVID is over, then that leg up will be over too. So, I mean, I think it's really interesting to see all this avatar fast-tracked immunity passports being sorted. And so people are obviously thinking about it. But yeah, sure, being COVID-free does take the risk out of committing lots of money and resource and having a real specific time frame and schedule. Because over here, we're having to be so careful about that because we're all thinking, well, when will the second wave hit?
Part of your role is sponsorship and partnership deals with big brands. What have you learned about how the most successful brands operate?
Well, once again, having money helps, Julie, but realistically, it's those brands that embrace and utilize new technologies. They're innovative, they're disruptive even, they're willing to really shake things up. And I think they have quite an attitude, which is act quickly, fail fast. So that mentality means that they're not left in the dust. And in particular, I'm sort of referencing, you know, technology, brands that are wanting to use services that I deal with at Storylab. So also, interestingly, with COVID, it's really brands who have a social conscience. So brands who've shown that they're not being short-term with their employees, consumers are really taking that kind of on board, as well as, you know, we're definitely starting to see more of a keenness for brands who are very sustainable and emotionally responsible. So not only eco brands, but also those willing to speak up and ensure that they're being diverse and inclusive. So that's been quite interesting.
Well, it's a big question, but what's your dream for the coast, which you clearly care about? So what would you like to see? Where would you like to see the coast in the future?
Well, you know, the coast is so unique, both in terms of its people, its amazing Jurassic coastline, and I wouldn't want to see huge changes, as we don't need any more cities in the world. But I do, of course, want the coast to prosper and want people feeling that they can be really successful and remain on the coast. And of course, don't get me wrong, successful means many different things to different people, but it would be really great if all sort of relevant opportunities across the board became available so that coasters aren't always forced to kind of make a leaving, staying decision. Mm. You have a Queenstown capital of New Zealand, and you have the home of Wales and Kaikoura. Well, the coast's hunting, fishing, glaciers, mountains, amazing tramps individually create quite a good tourism sort of wilderness playground narrative too. So I think there could be quite a lot of people doing little bits and pieces. And I think that if there was some sort of collective buy-in, then the West Coast could really, you know, join up and drive itself tourism-wise, which is something, a bit of a passion of mine. And it sounds a bit cheesy, like a package holiday to the coast, or like you would to Disneyland. But honestly, I do mean we could get a bit of a super ticket for the outdoors. So, you know, blackwater rafting, a Paparoa Great Walk, a helicopter ride and a glacier climb. And this is what Americans and Brits want if they're coming for a strict 3 weeks away from work commitments. You want a confirmed package of what they can do, itinerized by day, wrap it up with a camper van hire, or package it up with a car rental deal and vetted and verified accommodation. And it sounds full on, but it's actually not that unrealistic or difficult. And all it needs is someone specifically to be responsible for drawing this all together. And of course, sorting out, you know, an attractive website and doing some content marketing around it. So I think that's a real dream of mine for the coast.
West Coast super ticket.
Yeah.
Fabulous. When will we see you next down on the coast?
Well, I'd love to say Christmas, Julie, but I can't be sure about that with COVID. And like I've said, I'm not keen on quarantining with a toddler. So at some point, definitely in 2021, I'll be having a glass of wine in front of the batch fire, and mum would probably kill me not bringing Fred back to her if I didn't. So a lot of pressure.
So you clearly, could you define how you feel about the coast now? You've been away for so long. How long have you been away? You've been away 15, 20 years?
It's about probably 18 years. Yeah, good guess.
How do you feel about it now?
I mean, it's just a place that I just feel totally passionate and excited by and proud of. And it's just a weird feeling. Like, we usually come more from the direction of Christchurch. So you're sort of going through Kamara, and then I guess you're pulling through Parara. And I do love how often things don't seem to have changed hugely. But I also really love how, as I've said to mum and dad the last few times I've gone home, like, people just, you know, it looks so good. There's so many houses looking so good. And I don't know, I just have such a feeling of love for the coast. It's hard to put into words, and I would always give the shirt off my back to help it out. And also, you know, we always make a real effort whenever we come home to spend a good long time there, because I just think it's, yeah, just a place that has given me so much. So I'm always really keen to give it back. So yeah, a lot of love for the coast.
Well, we'll look forward to seeing you back there soon. Forever a coaster. Thank you. Thank you. Janice Sullivan.